recognize families for what they've endured as a loved one battles dementia during the crisis. Mayo Clinic's Angela Lundy says many of these individuals were already accustomed to social isolation even before the pandemic.
How do we come out of that darkness and really celebrate the fact that we now perhaps have a greater sense of empathy for what the experience of living with dementia can and always has been?
Organizers say that's why the message of hope is a perfect theme for the conference. In addition to stories, the online event includes tips to improve the well-being of people living with dementia. It begins Friday at 9:15 a.m. and runs through mid-afternoon. As for research, a recent study from England found Alzheimer's and COVID-19 share a genetic risk factor. Ann Wagner of Shakopee has been helping care for her husband, Steve, who was recently diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's. She says it's important for caregivers to remain a stabilizing force for everyone involved.
Trying to provide the best environment for both them and the care partner to live their best life.
Steve Wagner says even when there are setbacks in research to find a cure, it isn't a reason to lose hope. He says confirming his diagnosis has allowed him to focus on managing the disease.
In some ways, it was a relief. From before, we just didn't know what was going on.
And Mayo experts say there's promising news on the research front, noting that technology could soon make it easier for doctors to detect warning signs even before symptoms begin to surface. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
Author and former New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof announced today that he will run for Oregon governor as a Democrat in next year's election. Kristof joins an already crowded list of candidates for the governorship, including House Majority Leader Tina Kotek, State Treasurer Tobias Reed, and State Senator Betsy Johnson. While he grew up in Yamhill County and owns property there, Kristof has lived most of his life outside of Oregon. The state constitution specifies that a candidate for governor must have been an Oregon resident for 3 years prior to the election. Last year, Kristof voted in New York State. Just across the Columbia River, the city of Vancouver, Washington, is working on a plan to cut climate emissions. But despite the growing threat climate change poses in the Northwest, natural gas companies are pushing back. With more on the story, here's Eric Tegedoff.
As cities work toward decreasing their climate impact, they're running up against some opponents in the gas industry. In Washington State, Vancouver is developing its climate action plan, but activists in the community say Northwest Natural, the regional gas supplier, has ramped up its pace defending the fuel source. Northwest Natural has sent out flyers noting customers prefer gas stoves in their homes. But Alona Steinke, a Vancouver resident and retired nurse, points out that a growing number of health studies find these stoves are a major source of indoor pollution.
They were telling their customers that there's a small group of people who are trying to get the city to take away their gas. Well, it's not true, but I'm sure there are some who thought that they were going to lose their beloved gas stoves.
Northwest Natural says it has plans for reducing its carbon footprint, including the use of methane produced by cow manure and sewage treatment plants. The company is part of roundtable discussions taking place in Vancouver on its climate action plan. Northwest Natural's CEO and president, David Anderson, also is chair of the American Gas Association. Dylan Plummer with the Sierra Club in the region says cities and other local governments have faced roadblocks from the company and American Gas Association as they attempt to electrify buildings and appliances to meet their climate goals.
Northwest Natural is leading both a regional and a national effort to undermine these common sense climate policies and keep our communities hooked on methane gas.
Cities are feeling increasing pressure from and urgency to act on climate change. Alona's husband, Don Steinke, is also fighting for climate action in Vancouver. He says city council members initially asked how Vancouver could afford to cut its emissions so dramatically in the next few decades.
That was what they said before we had that 115 degree heat in that heat dome that we had. That was what they said then. And then at the next meeting, they said, we're all in, go for it. Do everything we possibly can to reduce emissions.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Wasco County and the Dallas City Commissioners gave Google tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in tax savings. The City Council voted unanimously yesterday to approve property tax breaks for two new data centers the company is building in the city. County Commissioners gave their approval last week that Google will pay $3 million in taxes up front for each of the data centers, with the first paying 50% of the normal property tax rate, the second 60%. Google's unpopular proposal to substantially increase water use for cooling data centers will be voted on by the commission early next month. Beaverton's Triton Transportation and Vancouver, Washington's Last Mile Delivery are suing Amazon for $15 million, citing unsafe and unreasonable working conditions that cause injuries to drivers. Both companies stopped delivering for Amazon in June because, as stated in a message to Last Mile drivers, quote, "Amazon has been nickel and diming us so bad." Amazon has faced opposition in Oregon from its employees, many of whom cited workplace injuries, assaults, mandatory overtime, and poor COVID precautions as major grievances. Drivers are contractors, not Amazon employees, but according to Triton and Last Mile, the company imposed restrictions that hurt contract workers. Amazon refused to allow drivers to slow down or remap delivery routes in dangerous driving conditions. Amazon would not reimburse drivers for more than 10 hours a day, although their restrictions often require drivers to put in hours of overtime. Amazon is also being sued for installing surveillance cameras in vehicles, controlling the physical appearance of drivers, and hijacking the hiring and firing process. The company also refused to pay drivers at market rate, forcing delivery companies to make up the cost. Triton and Last Mile also cited anti-competitive and unethical business practices, such as sharing confidential information about company operations and personnel with rival contractors. The FDA has approved a lower dose of the Pfizer vaccine for children as young as 5. However, some experts argue that more research is needed before the vaccine is widely used on children. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Giving parents the option to make that decision for themselves will be something that in history we will be glad that we were able to do.
Infectious disease doctor Avetta Fuller and other members of an FDA panel voted to approve a lower dose of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for children ages 5 to 11. Pharmacological consultant Dr. Beatrice Setnick was among experts who testified Tuesday. She argued that Pfizer has not released data on how the vaccine could spread in the body.
The overwhelmingly high likelihood of survival rate of 99.99% in children is not a justification for emergency use.
And President and CEO of Meharry Medical College, Dr. James Hildreth, pointed out disparities in the research.
I was disappointed that the number of minorities in the Pfizer study was such a small percentage of the total because they bear the brunt of disease and hospitalizations.
However, Captain Amanda Cohen with the National Center for Immunizations and Respiratory Diseases said the benefits outweigh the risks.
To me, the question is pretty clear. We don't want children to be dying of COVID, even if it is far fewer children than adults, and we don't want them in the ICU.
The FDA could issue a final decision this week. Meanwhile, a growing number of businesses are calling for the Biden administration to delay its vaccine mandate and testing rules until after the holidays. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration's emergency temporary standard requires the COVID-19 vaccine for workers at businesses with 100 or more employees. D.C.-based employment attorney Scott Hecker told lawmakers that stakeholders should have an opportunity to comment.
Nobody has the text of this ETS yet, at least in the regulated community. OSHA has it, OIRA has it. But beyond that, we don't know what's in it. So it's really hard to determine what the cost of testing allocation will be, paid time off requirements. And those are all practical impacts on employers.
Roughly 3,500 organizations and businesses have already adopted vaccination requirements. Progressive Democrats are pledging to block a vote on a bipartisan infrastructure bill until a deal is reached on a massive social spending package. Disagreements linger over Medicare expansion, paid family leave, and climate initiatives. Senate Democrats released a new plan Tuesday to help pay for the package that would apply a 15% minimum tax on profits for companies pulling in more than $1 billion. Terrorist groups in Afghanistan intend to strike international targets within the next 6 months. That's according to Defense Department Undersecretary Colin Call.
We could see ISIS-K generate that capability in somewhere between 6 or 12 months. I think the current assessments by the intelligence community is that Al-Qaeda would take a year or two.
Call testified to the Senate Armed Services Committee that 450 American citizens are still in Afghanistan following the U.S. withdrawal. Internal GOP polling finds Republicans leading Democrats on a generic ballot for the first time this cycle. Republicans are carrying independent voters by 8 points and college-educated white voters by 3 points. They tie with Democrats among Hispanic voters. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy online at publicnewsservice.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is more uncertain than ever.
Maybe the Democrats in Washington will get something done to help the rest of us, the economy, national infrastructure, the earth. Maybe they really want to, but certainly the Republicans won't let them. Maybe someone will throw water on Manchin and Sinema and they'll melt. Maybe Texas will become its own country. Maybe Donald Trump won't file a new lawsuit today. Maybe we won't need to get COVID booster shots every 6 months. Maybe the billionaires will stop investing in government officials. Maybe this will be an old normal winter. Maybe no one else will be shot dead in Portland this year. Maybe Ted Wheeler will find another job. Maybe one of the new homeless camps will be in the West Hills. We've had pandemic, flooding, droughts, fires. What's next? Locusts, inflation, American fascists. With the Day of the Dead coming up, let's celebrate the living, including the planet, with a one step at a time, certain commitment for life to flourish. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the importance of creating a legacy contact and online accounts, followed by Noise Filter. At 6, it's The Underground. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is rainy and temperatures will hover in the 50s. Tomorrow brings rain all day and highs in the mid-60s. Today in 1904, the New York subway opened its first line from City Hall to 145th Street. The quote of the day is from Jay-Z. New York has 1,000 universes in it that don't always connect, but we do all walk the same streets, hear the same sirens, ride the same subways, and see the same headlines in the Post, read the same writings on the walls. That shared landscape gets inside all of us and, in some small way, unites us, makes us think we know each other even when we don't. On January 6th, a deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol was intended to overturn the 2020 election and reinstate former President Donald Trump. Some of those attackers are now running for Congress as Republicans. Among them are Pennsylvania's Teddy Daniels, New York's Tina Forte, Wisconsin's Derek Van Orden, and New Hampshire's Jason Riddle. Riddle received particular attention when he revealed in an NBC interview that he wasn't sure which office he was running for. Of some 650 rioters who were charged, most received sentences of less than a year, and in some cases, less than a month. A congressional commission into the January 6th attack has revealed that organizers of the event participated in dozens of meetings with Republican members of Congress and White House staff. The commission subpoenaed several Trump aides, but the former president has ordered them not to testify. 3 years ago today, a right-wing attacker killed 11 and injured 6 at a Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania synagogue. Gunman Gregory Bowers purchased his assault rifle legally in the state. Since the attack, over 4,600 people have been killed by firearms in Pennsylvania, and state Republicans are attempting to pass legislation forbidding municipalities from enacting gun safety laws. Here's Emily Scott.
Today marks 3 years since the Tree of Life shooting in Pittsburgh, where 11 people at the synagogue were killed in a targeted anti-Semitic attack. State leaders and gun reform advocates say it's time for the General Assembly to pass what they see as common sense gun laws. October 2018 was also the last time the legislature enacted gun safety policy. Since then, 4,600 Pennsylvanians have died from gun-related injuries. In a news conference at the state capitol, Ceasefire PA's Adam Garber called on lawmakers to pass solutions to the state's pervasive gun violence problem.
We need policies to give someone a pause before they take their life, as Senator Fontana's extreme risk protection order does. And we need Senator Hughes's bill that will close a hole in our background check system that allows rifles and assault weapons to be privately sold without a background check. The simple fact is, we do not have to live like this.
Other proposals include a bill from Senator Tina Tartaglione that requires a firearm owner to report a lost or stolen gun within 24 hours to help stop the flow of illegal firearms in the Commonwealth. Democratic lawmakers and advocates are also concerned about current state gun legislation that's been described as dangerous. This includes Senate Bill 448, which would allow anyone to sue a local municipality for enacting gun safety policies, and Senate Bill 565, which would allow anyone over 18 to carry a concealed firearm without a permit. Senator Anthony Williams of Philadelphia thinks both bills leave people in possession of guns unaccountable.
Despite public outcry, countless vigils, we'd rather, as a legislature, not burn a moment of midnight oil on finding solutions to this cascade of death across Pennsylvania. For some here in the Senate, Republicans, the solution is easier access and more guns.
Senate Minority Leader Jay Costa says Senate Bills 448 and 565 were poised to run out of committee this week, but are now postponed because of the Tree of Life anniversary. I'm Emily Scott with Keystone State News Connection.
The first U.S. passport with a non-binary gender designation has been issued, the State Department announced today. Recipients can opt instead to list their gender as X. The department expects to offer the option more broadly next year. It was not announced who received the passport, but some expect that it was Dana Zim, an intersex Colorado resident who has been in a legal battle with the State Department since 2015. Updating the passport application and system with an X designation option still needs to be approved by the Office of Management and Budget. The U.S. will be joining a handful of countries, including Australia, New Zealand, Nepal, and Canada, that allow their citizens to designate a gender other than male or female on their passports. Senators Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin threaten climate provisions in President Biden's reconciliation bill. In America's driest state, green energy legislation could be a path to survival. From Nevada, Susanna Potter has more on the story.
As Democrats work feverishly for a deal on the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the reconciliation bill, groups working to curb the effects of climate change say both are crucial to Nevada's economy. The Build Back Better reconciliation bill includes billions to promote clean energy and clean transportation. Kevin Moran with Environmental Defense Fund Action says the Silver State is already suffering the effects of a warming climate with devastating heat waves, wildfire, and drought. And he insists the way out is paved with clean energy jobs.
Climate change is barging down the door in the American West, and it's time for us to take on the underlying causes of it in a way that grows our economy.
The Build Back Better agenda includes incentives to increase the number of electric vehicle charging stations, and the so-called hard infrastructure bill includes $4.6 billion for rebuilding aging infrastructure and rural water projects, including $400 million for water-saving programs to protect against drought. Moran says Nevada, considered by some to be the sunniest state in the nation, is poised to benefit greatly from the solar incentives in the reconciliation bill.
There's over 30,000 people employed in clean energy jobs already in Nevada. Provisions in the Build Back Better agenda would double the number of clean energy jobs in Nevada, adding over 31,000.
President Joe Biden's plan would also invest $2.2 billion in Nevada's energy efficiency projects and $311 million in projects to modernize the power grid. For Nevada News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Although he declined to attend the United Nations COP26 climate in Glasgow, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced plans to reduce his country's emissions to 70% of 1990 levels in the next 10 years. However, because of deindustrialization after the breakup of the Soviet Union, the world's fourth largest carbon emitter could actually increase emissions and still hit that goal. Instead of transitioning to alternative energy, Russian companies have decided to invest $10 billion over the next 5 years in developing new shipping lanes in the Arctic Circle and opening new venues for mining and natural gas extraction. Analysts say that at least six large Russian energy, shipping, and mining firms could stand to profit from the effects of climate change in the Arctic. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, fossil fuels have become the Russian Federation's lifeline. Their sales account for 36% of the state budget, and the country uses its natural gas pipelines for political leverage in the European Union, as well as justification for violent intervention in Ukraine. Additionally, Russian plans to expand its fossil fuel network into China could double coal and gas exports to that country. According to experts at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, even if the Russian government were serious about decarbonizing, it would face major hurdles. The country's power grid and economy rely overwhelmingly on fossil fuels, And Russian industry lacks the innovative climate that allowed China to become the world's largest producer of solar panels and electric cars. Nonetheless, the country has faced drastic consequences from climate change, including fires in the Siberian taiga that burned millions of acres this summer. The Biden administration renewed protections for Bear Ears National Monument, a site sacred to several tribal nations. The drive to restore Bear Ears to its original size was driven by tribal groups, as well as Laguna Pueblo member and Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders in the Southwest are applauding President Biden's decision earlier this month to return protections to Bears Ears National Monument in Utah. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, a group made up of five tribes was instrumental in advocating for the redesignation.
The Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition is made up of the Hopi, Navajo, Zuni, Ute Mountain Ute, and Ute Indian tribes. The area is their ancestral homeland and contains thousands of sacred cultural sites and other areas of deep spiritual significance. About two dozen other tribal nations and pueblos also have connections to the area. Leaders of the tribes, U.S. Interior Secretary and Pueblo of Laguna member Deb Haaland and others, were on hand at the White House October 8th to witness President Biden return the monument to its original size. Hopi Vice Chairman Clark Tenakongva is co-chair of the Intertribal Coalition and was among them.
For me, as a tribal leader and as a cultural leader, it was very refreshing, a sigh of relief, a breath of new air. The government recognized the significance and how we are part of America. Today.
The Intertribal Coalition formed in 2015 during the lead-up to then-President Barack Obama's original designation of more than 1.3 million acres of Bears Ears as a national monument. They continued to advocate for the return of federal protections after President Donald Trump slashed the monument's size by 85% in 2017, opening the lands to mineral, oil, and gas development. Biden's order returns Bears Ears to its previous size and keeps about 11,000 acres added by Trump. It also reestablishes the Bears Ears Commission to provide tribal guidance for federal agencies in developing and implementing the monument's new management plan. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
Tribal leaders, U.S. lawmakers, White House, and federal officials celebrated the 25th anniversary of a law which has helped tribes develop programs tailored to fit their unique communities' housing needs. On Tuesday, a virtual gathering marked the passage of the Native American Housing Assistance and Self-Determination Act, known as NAHASDA. Tribal leaders who were instrumental in the bill's passage reflected on their work. Joe Garcia is head councilman from Okeawinge Pueblo in New Mexico. He says there was a lot of negotiating and learning happening at that time.
I knew my community, and I knew what the needs were, and housing was a dire need. But in terms of the NAHASDA stuff, I think one thing that we wanted to get away from is the fact that the housing programs in the country for Indian country had always been housing for low-income families. And we said, NAHASDA is a better way. You can still address the low-income housing, but what we want to do is use the self-determination and say, hey, we don't want to have low-income housing forever. What we want is a housing that delivers to all tribal members.
Under NAHASDA, tribes can offer any combination of low-income assistance, address housing needs of healthcare workers, law enforcement, and other professionals, student and elder housing, veterans, home ownership, and other opportunities. The event celebrated the progress in tribal housing, but also acknowledged the many unmet housing needs across Indian country, and funding spread thin to serve more than 500 tribal communities. The bill was signed into law by President Clinton in 1996. The California legislature is holding an informational hearing Wednesday on Native American curriculum and student success. A joint committee will hear from the state superintendent of public instruction, educators, tribal members, and two Washington state lawmakers who enacted legislation to improve Native student success. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 27th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael. The producer is myself, Ethan Sandweiss, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mike Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, Mike Moen, Susanna Potter, and Emily Scott. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth report on the importance of creating a legacy contact in online accounts.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
What is it that we leave behind? For those of us who've grown up on the internet, we know about some things you shouldn't leave behind online and some things that you will no matter what. Passwords, internet history, public posts, they're all things to be careful of who has access to them. But what about digital mementos? On certain email providers and social medias, there's an option to create a legacy contact to allow a loved one to inherit your data once your account is inactive for a period of time. To learn more about the importance of setting up a legacy contact, I spoke with Camille Demir, who works in social media and marketing. So you brought something to my attention that I wanted to ask you more about, which is emails and not being around to answer them anymore.
A lot of people don't.